This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. So there's a question about child support and whether a government should force a man to pay child support. And let me just say, you know, this relates to legal philosophy, so, you know, which I'm not an expert on. So again, I'm going to give you my thoughts on this. And the questioner goes on to ask, he says, what if the woman lied about using birth control? Or why is a man responsible for a child until he's 18 years old just because he had one night of sex and so on? I mean, my understanding of child support, and again, I'm no expert on this, is, well, let me put aside my understanding of child support. The way I believe child support should be is if a man is committed to having a child, then he's taken on a responsibility for 18 years. But if a woman comes to a man and says, look, I'm pregnant with your child, and the man says, look, I don't want the child. Here's money for an abortion. An abortion is legal, as it should be. I want to have nothing to do with this child. I want out, and I'm willing to pay for an abortion. And a woman says, no, I'm going to have this child whether you like it or not, then I don't think he should have to pay for it. But once he's made the committed, let's say the woman comes to him and says, look, I'm considering having an abortion. What do you think? And he says, no, keep the child, or I won't support the abortion. I won't fund it, or whatever. Then he's taken on the responsibility. Then he's taken on the responsibility of this human being. I mean, the only alternative then is to put up the child for adoption, in which, again, I think once you give up the child to adoption, you're not taking on the responsibility of paying child support. Now, if you're married and you get a divorce, then when you're married and you had a child, you took on that responsibility. So it's really a question of, has the man taken on the responsibility of having the child and then reneged on it either through divorce or leaving or saying, I've changed my mind? You can't change your mind. Once the child is born, once abortion is no longer an option, then you have that responsibility. But I agree with you. If the woman lied, if you're willing to fund the abortion, if you've expressly stated you don't want this child and there's a possibility not to have it and the woman decides to have it anyway, then I think you're absolved from paying child support. And I think that's how the law is today. You know, I guess I'm not sure, but that would be what I would expect the law to be in a rational society. Here's a question on Milton Friedman. Why did Ayn Rand disapprove of Milton Friedman? Well, I think there are a number of reasons. One is that Friedman purposefully avoided the issue of the morality of capitalism. He would give some political justifications for capitalism, i.e. freedom, but he would not go to the level of morality. He would not challenge the altruism inherent in our culture. And Ayn Rand believed that unless you provided a moral justification of capitalism, it was useless to fight for capitalism. But Friedman did worse. He said that morality doesn't matter in a sense. Any moral code could justify capitalism. And Ayn Rand, of course, completely disagrees with this. She argues that only a morality of self-interest can validate capitalism, then indeed a morality of altruism is consistent with socialism, not with capitalism. That is one reason. So Milton Friedman, to broaden it, was not explicitly philosophical and did not see the role of philosophy in defending capitalism. But it was more than that. Friedman had an explicitly bad epistemology, and you can see it in his writing on economic methodology. And I think, again, Ayn Rand, whether she knew of these articles or not, I think she recognized this bad philosophy at the core of his methodology. And that has to do with this whole idea of falsifiability. I think it comes from Karl Popper. And Rand is completely opposed to this type of science. You come up with an idea and you test it. And as long as it predicts, as long as it's the theory that you've come up with, randomly, supposedly, Friedman says, as long as when you run the empirical test, it can predict the results, then it's a good theory. And Ayn Rand would say that's bizarre. You start with reality, and you basically induce from reality a theory, and then you use empiricism to test that theory. But you don't start with whatever you feel like it. And this is a big part, and again, not my area of expertise. I encourage you to read on the philosophy of science. But this is a big corruption of the whole field of sciences, and I think in economics, is this notion that, you know, theories can come from anywhere. Theories, can come from inside your own head. Doesn't have to start with the facts of reality. And this is the whole, you know, you get this mathematical economics that's completely divorced from reality, divorced from the facts as they are, or these theories in physics that have nothing to do with anything in reality. They're just beautiful mind games that people are playing. And then as long as it somehow can predict something or presents a falsifiable alternative, you know, anyway, I think she disapproved of this whole way of doing epistemology. And if you're interested in Rand's epistemology, I encourage you to read Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology and also Dr. Peikoff's Objectivism and the Philosophy of Ayn Rand in his latest book, Dim, The Dim Hypothesis, which covers some issues in epistemology. Lastly, I'd say this, that because of real philosophical differences, Ayn Rand disapproved of Milton Friedman's compromises. So the fact that Friedman was for, at least most of his life, was for Federal Reserve, I think Ayn Rand objected to, I know Ayn Rand objected to quite vehemently. There's no reason to have a Federal Reserve, a laissez-faire capitalist market, and it's kind of bizarre to say markets work everywhere except for money, except for banking. That's ridiculous. There were many issues like this where he allowed for certain compromises. The whole idea of withholding was a Milton Friedman idea, withholding tax, so that you don't actually have to write a check to the government. They just take it out of your paycheck. He called it the worst idea he ever had, and I think it was. The idea of creating a negative income tax is a Milton Friedman idea that I think Ayn Rand would have opposed quite vehemently. So negative income tax, you would get income from the government if you were poor. If you earned below a certain rate, it would be supplemented by the government. And then lastly, in some of his articles, the way he used concepts really upset her. So there's a famous article in which Milton Friedman talks about, I think it was about rent control. And in it, he refers to, the two ways of rationing housing. You can use the market to ration it, or you can use government to ration it. And Ayn Rand just blew up about things like that. Rationing is a term of force. Rationing is a term of coercion. Only government rations. The market can allocate through a particular voluntary mechanism of the supply and demand and through prices. That's not rationing. And to use a term of force like rationing to describe a market phenomena would drive Ayn Rand crazy. I mean, rationally, it would make her angry. And this is why these are the many reasons she disapproved of Milton Friedman. I have probably a more positive view of Milton Friedman than Rand did. I agree with all of her critiques. But just qua economist and qua explainer of certain economic principles, I think Milton Friedman was very good. I mean, I don't think he was the greatest. I think he was wrong on many things that Ayn Rand described. But I think he did a lot to educate Americans about the virtues of markets and about the virtues of capitalism. And I think he and Ayn Rand together are the two who really resurrected the concept of capitalism and made it acceptable in the public sphere in the 1970s going into the 1980s. And I doubt that Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and the kind of revolutions, or, you know, kind of short-term revolutions, but the change in America's thinking about capitalism would have happened if not for Ayn Rand and possibly if not for some of what Milton Friedman did. Although, as she would argue, and I think I'd agree, Milton Friedman also sows the seeds for the anti-capitalist swing that we've taken in recent years because of his compromises. So here's a question about urban parks. So the argument is, there are no urban parks in America, with the exception maybe of Central Park and Golden Gate. Public parks just don't exist in many American cities. They're just not out there. It's not part of the way cities are developed in America. Instead, we have private golf courses and we have development, big development projects. In socialist countries like Europe, Australia, and Canada, you have lots of urban parks and it's a norm. And isn't this absence of urban parks in the United States a clear example of failure of capitalist thinking? Wow, where do I start? So first, urban planning is not capitalist thinking. Urban planning is central planning. It's not the role of the state, including local little states like cities, to plan. The planning happens through the price, supply and demand marketplace. That's where planning should happen. And by the way, Central Park was established by local businessmen. It was a private park established by private people on private land. It wasn't established through urban, so-called urban planning. So I'm against the whole concept of mass-scale urban planning. But the way to think about this qua capitalist thinking is to say this. If there's enormous demand for urban parks, if people really want urban parks, then they'd be willing to invest in urban parks. And therefore, they'd be willing to pull their resources together to create them and to set some property aside. Or if developers were developing one of these real estate communities, those communities that were developed with a park inside of them would sell for a premium over those that did not have a park inside of them. So the capitalist way of thinking is, if this has value, you would be willing to pay for it. You would be willing to take some property and make it into an urban park, not through coercion, i.e. urban planning, central planning, city management, and so on, but through the voluntary mechanisms of a marketplace. If something is valuable, the marketplace will deliver it if people are willing to pay enough to make it available. And that's true of urban parks as well. There are a lot of reasons, though, why in the United States we don't value urban parks the same as they do in Europe. We in the United States, particularly, I'd say in most of the United States, live in large homes, much, much, much larger, by the way, than Europeans, with big back and front yards, often with a pool in the backyard, sometimes with a pool in the backyard, often with a playset in the backyards. And the need we have for a big urban park just doesn't exist. Also, a lot of the communities in which we live do have parks. I live in a gated community. We have a baseball field. We have two golf courses that people who really value golf are willing to pay membership fees for. But then we have parks and we have a sports center and we have other things. And some of it, you need to book in advance, and maybe if you wanted the sports field and so on, so you pay for it. But there's also a lot of grass everywhere that people can use and so on. So people in America live in bigger homes with bigger plots of land. The need for this is smaller, and therefore they're less eager to fund these kind of parks. I also am not sure just empirically. I'm sure that Europe has more parks, but I can think of a big, huge park in Austin, Texas. I think it's called Zilker Park with Barton Creek in the middle. Driving around Dallas, there seems to be quite a lot of green areas in which they – so I'm not sure the premise is true in that America doesn't have them at all. I think what's true is that the need for them in the United States is smaller. We also have much more space outside of our cities. It's just a bigger place. But to accuse us of not having it because capitalist thinking is just bizarre, given the fact that the whole idea of city planning is not capitalist thinking.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peakoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.